Chapter 20. Appetite, and was also a teetotaler. I don't remember to have heard the lady's voice, though I might, not unnaturally, have been curious to hear it. Was her voice a deep, rich, magnificent bass, or was it soft, fluty, and mild? I shall never know now. Even if she comes to this country, I shall never go and see her. I have seen her, and for nothing. You would have fancied that, as after all we were only some half dozen on board, she might have dispensed with her red handkerchief, untalked, and eaten her dinner in comfort. But in covering her chin there was a kind of modesty. That beard was her profession. That beard brought the public to see her. Out of her business she wished to put that beard aside, as it were, as a barrister would wish to put off his wig. I know some who carry theirs into private life, and who mistake you and me for jury boxes when they address us. But these are not your modest barristers, not your true gentlemen. Well, I own I respected the lady for the modesty with which, her public business over, she retired into private life. She respected her life, and her beard. That beard having done its day's work, she puts it away in her handkerchief, and becomes, as far as in her lies, a private ordinary person. All public men and women of good sense, I should think, have this modesty. When, for instance, in my small way, poor Mrs. Brown comes simpering up to me, with her album in one hand, a pen in the other, and says, "Ho, ho, dear Mr. Roundabout, write us one of your amusing, and see." And see, my beard drops behind my handkerchief instantly. Why am I to wag my chin, and grin for Mrs. Brown's good pleasure? My dear madam, I have been making faces all day. It is my profession. I do my comic business with the greatest pains, seriousness, and trouble, and with it make, I hope, a not dishonest livelihood. If you ask Mons, Blondin to tea, you don't have a rope stretched from your garret window to the opposite side of the square, and request Monsieur to take his tea out on the center of the rope? I lay my hand on this waistcoat, and declare that not once in the course of our voyage together did I allow the Kentucky giant to suppose I was speculating on his stature, or the bearded lady to surmise that I wished to peep under the handkerchief which muffled the lower part of her face. "N.D. the more fool you," says some cynic. Faugh, those cynics, I hate 'em. Don't you know, sir, that a man of genius is pleased to have his genius recognized, that a beauty likes to be admired, that an actor likes to be applauded, that stout old Wellington himself was pleased, and smiled when the people cheered him as he passed? Suppose you had paid some respectful compliment to that lady? Suppose you had asked that giant if, for once, he would take anything at the liquor bar, you might have learned a great deal of curious knowledge regarding giants and bearded ladies, about whom you evidently now know very little. There was that little boy of 3 years old, with a fine beard already, and his little legs and arms, as seen out of his little frock, covered with a dark down. What a queer little capering satyr! He was quite good-natured, childish, rather solemn. He had a little Norval dress, I remember. The drollest little Norval. I have said the B-50. Had another child. Now this was a little girl of some 6 years old, as fair and as smooth of skin, dear madam, as your own darling cherubs. She wandered about the great cabin quite melancholy. No one seemed to care for her. All the family affections were centered on Master S. yonder. His little beard was beginning to be a little fortune already, whereas Mistress Alba was of no good to the family. No one would pay a cent to see her little fair face. No wonder the poor little maid was melancholy. As I looked at her, I seemed to walk more and more in a fairy tale, and more in a cavern of ogres. Was this a little fondling whom they had picked up in some forest, where lie the picked bones of the queen, her tender mother, and the tough old defunct monarch, her father? No. Doubtless they were quite good-natured people, these. I don't believe they were unkind to the little girl without the mustaches. It may have been only my fancy that she repined, Because as he had a cheek no more bearded than a rose's. Would you wish your own daughter, madam, to have a smooth cheek, a modest air, and a gentle feminine behavior, or to be I won't say a whiskered prodigy, like this bearded lady of Kentucky, but a masculine wonder, a virago, a female personage of more than female strength, courage, wisdom. Some authors, who shall be nameless, are, I know, accused of depicting the most feeble, brainless, namby-pammy heroines, forever whimpering tears and prattling commonplaces. You would have the heroine of your novel, so beautiful that she should charm the captain or hero, whoever he may be, with her appearance, surprise and confound the bishop with her learning, outright the squire, and get the brush, and, when he fell from his horse, whip out a lancet and bleed him, rescue from fever and death the poor cottager's family whom the doctor had given up. Make 21 at the butts with the rifle, when the poor captain only scored 18. Give him 20 and 50 at billiards and beat him, and draw tears from the professional Italian people by her exquisite performance of voice and violoncello in the evening. I say, if a novelist would be popular with ladies, the great novel readers of the world, this is the sort of heroine who would carry him through half a dozen editions. Suppose I had asked that bearded lady to sing? Confess, now, miss, you would not have been displeased, if I had told you that as he had a voice like Lablake, only ever so much lower. My dear, you would like to be a heroine? You would like to travel in triumphal caravans, to see your effigy placarded on city walls, to have your levees attended by admiring crowds, all crying out, was there ever such a wonder of a woman? You would like admiration? Consider the tax you pay for it. You would be alone were you eminent. Were you so distinguished from your neighbors, I will not say by a beard and whiskers, that were odious, but by a great and remarkable intellectual superiority would you, do you think, be any the happier? Consider envy. Consider solitude. Consider the jealousy and torture of mind which this Kentucky lady must feel. Suppose she should hear that there is, let us say, a Miss Sourey prodigy, with a beard larger than hers? Consider how she is separated from her kind by the possession of that wonder of a beard. When that beard grows gray, how lonely she will be, the poor old thing. If it falls off, the public admiration falls off too. And how she will miss it, the compliments of the trumpeters, the admiration of the crowd, the gilded progress of the car. I see an old woman alone in a decrepit old caravan, with cobwebs on the knocker, with a blistered ensign flapping idly over the door. Would you like to be that deserted person? Ah, Clo. To be good, to be simple, to be modest, to be loved, be thy lot. Be thankful thou art not taller, nor stronger, nor richer, nor wiser than the rest of the world. On Let's Diary. Mine is one of your number 12 diaries, 3 shillings cloth boards, silk limp, gilt edges, 3 and 6, French Morocco, tuck ditto, 4 and 6. It has 2 pages, ruled with faint lines for memoranda, for every week, and a ruled account at the end, for the 12 months from January to December, where you may set down your incomings and your expenses. I hope yours, my respected reader, are large, that there are many fine round sums of figures on each side of the page. Liberal on the expenditure side, greater still on the receipt. I hope, sir, you will be better man, as they say, in 62 than in this moribund 61 whose career of life is just coming to its terminus. A better man in purse? In body? In soul's health? Amen, good sir, in all. Who is there, so good in mind, body or estate, but bettering won't still be good for him? O unknown fate, presiding over next year, if you will give me better health, a better appetite, a better digestion, a better income, a better temper in 62 than you have bestowed in 61, I think your servant will be the better for the changes. For instance, I should be the better for a new coat. This one, I acknowledge, is very old. The family says so. My good friend, who amongst us would not be the better, if he would give up some old habits? Yes, yes. You agree with me. You take the allegory? Alas! At our time of life we don't like to give up those old habits, do we? It is ill to change. There is the good old lucy slovenly bedgown, laziness, for example. What man of sense likes to fling it off, and put on a tight-skinned prim dress coat that pinches him? There is the cozy rapscallion, self-indulgence, how easy it is. How warm. How it always seems to fit. You can walk out in it. You can go down to dinner in it. You can say of such, what Tully says of his books. Per nocte nobiscum, peregrinator, rusticator. It is a little slatternly, it is a good deal stained, it isn't becoming, it smells of cigar smoke. But, Alan's donk, let the world call me idle and sloven. I love my ease better than my neighbor's opinion. I live to please myself, not you, Mr. Dandy, with your supercilious airs. I am a philosopher. Perhaps I live in my tub, and don't make any other use of it. We won't pursue further this unsavory metaphor, but, with regard to some of your old habits, let us say, 1. The habit of being censorious, and speaking ill of your neighbors. 2. The habit of getting into a passion with your manservant, your maidservant, your daughter, wife, and c. 3. The habit of indulging too much at table. 4. The habit of smoking in the dining room after dinner. 5. The habit of spending insane sums of money in bric-a-brac, tall copies, binding, Elsevier's, and c. 20 port, outrageously fine horses, ostentatious entertainments, and what not. Or, 6. The habit of screwing meanly, when rich, and chuckling over the saving of half a crown, whilst you are poisoning your friends and family with bad wine. 7. The habit of going to sleep immediately after dinner, instead of cheerfully entertaining Mrs. Jones and the family. Or, 8. Ladies, the habit of running up bills with the milliners, and swindling paterfamilias on the house bills. 9. The habit of keeping them waiting for breakfast. 10. The habit of sneering at Mrs. Brown and the Miss Browns, because they are not quite du monde, or quite so genteel as Lady Smith. 11. The habit of keeping your wretched father up at balls till 5 o'clock in the morning, when he has to be at his office at 11. 12. The habit of fighting with each other, dear Louia, Jane, Arabella, Amelia. 13. The habit of always ordering John Coachman, 3/4 hour before you want him. Such habits, I say, sir or madam, if you have had to note in your diary of 61, I have not the slightest doubt you will enter in your pocketbook of 62. There are habits knows. 4 and 7 for example. I am morally sure that some of us will not give up those bad customs, though the women cry out and grumble, and scold ever so justly. There are habits knows. 9 and 13. I feel perfectly certain, my dear young ladies, that you will continue to keep John Coachman waiting, that you will continue to give the most satisfactory reasons for keeping him waiting. And as for 9, you will show that you once, on the 1st of April last, let us say, came to breakfast first, and that you are always first in consequence. Yes. In our 62 diaries, I fear we may all of us make some of the 61 entries. There is my friend Freehand, for instance. Aha! Master Freehand, how you will laugh to find yourself here. F is in the habit of spending a little, ever so little, more than his income. He shows you how Mrs. Freehand works, and works, and indeed Jack Freehand, if you say she is an angel, you don't say too much of her, how they toil, and how they mend, and patch, and pinch, and how they can't live on their means. And I very much fear, nay, I will bet them half a bottle of Gladstone 14s. Or doesn't claret, that the account which is a little on the wrong side this year, will be a little on the wrong side in the next ensuing year of grace. A diary. Dies. Hody. How queer to read, are some of the entries in the journal. Here are the records of dinners eaten, and gone the way of flesh. The lights burn blue somehow, and we sit before the ghosts of victuals. Hark at the dead jokes resurging. Memory greets them with the ghost of a smile. Here are the lists of the individuals who have dined at your own humble table. The agonies endured before and during those entertainments are renewed, and smart again. What a failure that special grand dinner was! How those dreadful occasional waiters did break the old china! What a dismal ash poor Mary, the cook, made of the French dish which she would try out of Francatelli! How angry Mrs. Pope was at not going down to dinner before Mrs. Bishop! How Trimalcio sneered at your absurd attempt to give a feast, and Harpagon cried out at your extravagance and ostentation! How Lady Elmack bullied the other ladies in the drawing room when no gentlemen were present, Colin never asked you back to dinner again, left her card by her footman, and took not the slightest notice of your wife and daughters at Lady Hustleby's assembly. On the other hand, how easy, cozy, merry, comfortable those little dinners were, got up at 1 or 2 days' notice, when everybody was contented, the soup as clear as amber, the wine as good as Trimalcio's own, and the people kept their carriages waiting, and would not go away until midnight. Along with the catalogue of bygone pleasures, balls, banquets, and the like, which the pages record, comes a list of much more important occurrences, and remembrances of graver import. On 2 days of Dives' diary are printed notices that dividends are due at the bank. Let us hope, dear sir, that this announcement considerably interests you, in which case, probably, you have no need of the almanac maker's printed reminder. If you look over poor Jack Reckless's notebook, amongst his memoranda of racing odds given and taken, perhaps you may read. Abham's bill, due 29th September, 142L15s. 60. Let us trust, as the day has passed, that the little transaction here noted has been satisfactorily terminated. If you are paterfamilias, and a worthy kind gentleman, no doubt you have marked down on your register, 17th December, say, boys come home. Ah, how carefully that blessed day is marked in their little calendars. In my time it used to be, Wednesday, 13th November, 5 weeks from the holidays. Wednesday, 20th November, 4 weeks from the holidays, until sluggish time sped on, and we came to Wednesday, 8th December. Oh rapture! Do you remember pea shooters? I think we only had them on going home for holidays from private schools. At public schools men are too dignified. And then came that glorious announcement, Wednesday, 27th, Papa took us to the pantomime. Or if not Papa, perhaps you condescended to go to the pit, under charge of the footman. That was near the end of the year and Mama gave you a new pocketbook, perhaps, with a little coin, God bless her, in the pocket. And that pocketbook was for next year, you know, and, in that pocketbook you had to write down that sad day, Wednesday, January 24th. 1800 and never mind what, when Dr. Birch's young friends were expected to reassemble. Ah me! Every person who turns this page over has his own little diary, in paper or ruled in his memory tablets, and in which are set down the transactions of the now dying year. Boys and men, we have our calendar, mothers and maidens. For example, in your calendar pocketbook, my good Eliza, what a sad, sad day, that is how fondly and bitterly remembered, when your boy went off to his regiment, to India, to danger, to battle perhaps. What a day was that last day at home, when the tall brother sat yet amongst the family, the little ones round about him wondering at saddle boxes, uniforms, sword cases, gun cases, and other wondrous apparatus of war and travel which poured in, and filled the hall, the new dressing case for the beard not yet grown, the great sword case at which little brother Tom looked so admiringly. What a dinner that was, that last dinner, when little and grown children assembled together, and all tried to be cheerful. What a night was that last night, when the young ones were at roost for the last time together under the same roof, and the mother lay alone in her chamber counting the fatal hours as they told one after another, amidst her tears, her watching, her fond prayers. What a night that was, and yet how quickly the melancholy dawn came. Only too soon the sun rose over the houses. And now in a moment more the city seemed to wake. The house began to stir. The family gathers together for the last meal. For the last time in the midst of them the widow kneels amongst her kneeling children, and falters a prayer in which she commits her Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.